This episode of Inside Briefing has been produced in association with Naus Group. Naus is an international management consultancy with deep expertise working with public sector leaders on their organisational design challenges. Hello and welcome to Inside Briefing, the podcast from the Institute for Government. I'm Hannah White. The May general election is off, if it was ever on. So now what? The Prime Minister predicts that 2024 is the year the economy will bounce back. But the Conservatives are still trailing in the polls, and Rishi Sunak's flagship Rwanda bill is taking a battering in the House of Lords. So, is the economy really on the up? How significant are those Rwanda bill defeats? And most importantly for Sunak's immediate job prospects, how serious are the rumours of a plot to topple the PM? Could the Conservative Party really pick a sixth leader and therefore Prime Minister since 2010? We'll take a closer look. And then to Labour, because this week Rachel Reeves has made a major speech on the economy and made headlines by apparently making comparisons with Margaret Thatcher, which seems to be a bit of a theme for the opposition. We'll examine what the Shadow Chancellor has been up to. And finally, all-male private members clubs. Are they a good thing? We'll give our verdict. I bet you can't guess what I think later in the podcast. Joining me today are two top IFG colleagues, neither of whom I believe are members of the Garrick Club. That's Senior Fellows Charles Wilkes and Jill Rutter. Hi, both.
Hi, Hannah.
Hi, Hannah.
And I'm delighted that The Spectator's assistant editor, Isabel Hardman, is dialing in from Scotland. Hi, Isabel. How are you?
I'm okay, thank you.
Okay, so let's begin by asking just how much trouble Rishi Sunak is actually in. The PM had a session with Conservative backbenchers this week and was greeted by, it has been reported, raucous bashing of desks. Isabel, your column in the iPaper this week took a look at plotting against Sunak. Is this real or is it just psychodrama?
I mean, I think it is real. And I think there are a number of different groups plotting with different timescales. But that's been the case for a while. What has shifted over the past 2 weeks is that you've now got Tory MPs who are really not just staring down the barrel of an election defeat, because I think they've priced that in for quite a while. It's also staring down the barrel of a very bad election defeat and starting to wonder whether the man who most of them thought was probably doing the best of an extremely difficult job to try to stem the losses, keep the show on the road, restore some dignity, and so on, whether he is actually also a reason for the party continuing to slide in the polls and stay, 18 points behind Labour. And so that's what the shift is that you've actually got Tory MPs who are now saying, well, I did used to think that changing leader again would be the stupidest thing we could possibly do. But now I'm wondering whether actually continuing with Rishi Sunak in charge is quite damaging too. And I wouldn't say this is a majority, but I think it's just an interesting psychological shift where you've got more MPs thinking that Rishi Sunak might have something to do with it. And some of them are thinking, as Ben Wallace articulated, I don't think we could even describe this as a backhanded compliment this week when he said that Tory MPs just needed to march towards the sound of gunfire. But his view is basically, it's too late. This is the guy we've got. You've just got to crack on, guys. Or, and this is still quite a small group, the MPs who think we've got to try something else because that will still be less bad than what we've got at the moment. So it's all quite desperate, I think.
And as you say, I mean, time is running short in terms of the people who've been mooted as, possibly being replacements for Sunak, Penny Mordaunt, Tom Tugendhat, and so on. Do they really want to take over at this point? Like, what is the calculation from their point of view?
Well, I think this is another interesting question, is who is doing the talking up? Is it the candidates who have been mentioned this week? Is it Tom Tugendhat? Is it Penny Mordaunt? Or are they being talked up? And I think it's the latter. And it's not always for reasons that are beneficial to the names that are out there at the moment. So if you want to damage someone's long-term leadership prospects, you make them look desperate, you make them look disloyal, you make them look as though they're sort of quite trigger happy. And when it comes down to actually deciding who should be leader, rather than deciding whether to get rid of the current one, you don't go for the, you know, we don't have stalking horses in Conservative Party rules anymore, but you do have people who bring about a collapse. Do you go for the person who brought about a collapse, or do you go for the person who actually you trust to repair that collapse? And so I think that's certainly one of the theories from some of the Penny Morden camp, is that she's being talked up for kind of nefarious reasons by the right, who want to destroy her. Another theory is that she was talked up because there's a Tory row on defence spending bubbling along. And I tend to see defence spending really as a bit of a lightning rod for where the Tory kind of morale is more generally. But it's a way of trying to bring defence back to the centre of debate by making it a leadership issue. So I think there's, you know, there's a lot of people taking part in this who don't actually want either of those two names who we've had this week to be leader.
Really interesting. Giles, this week we saw various pieces of economic news and the Prime Minister claiming a corner is being turned. Is he right?
Well, you know, I mean, the corner's being turned if you count going from sort of zero growth to like 0.5% growth and inflation being out of target to back where it should have been and has been normally for like 20 years as a great corner. But for a lot of people, this will just feel like confirmation that our standards have been disastrously lowered over the last 15 or 20 years. If you listen to other sort of prominent former chancellors, this is the only policy he should be pursuing, which is saying, yes, there have been really tough times. It wasn't all of our fault, but we are the only people who can be trusted to nurture this this sort of flickering flame of a recovery. And if the other lot come in, it'll all go back to hell in a handcart. And it worked in 1992, it worked in 2015. And those are the two great sort of recovery stories that previous Conservative governments have enjoyed and which this one would love to emulate. But is there much of a recovery? The thing is, it wasn't much of a recession. In a sense, where Rishi Sunak's been unlucky is that if you do go back 15, 18 months to when Liz Truss was in power, we were expecting both a really high, high interest rates, which we've got, but also a really steep recession that everyone would have noticed. The Bank of England was predicting unemployment to hit 6% at one point. We didn't get that. And he's not getting any credit for avoiding that. Instead, we're just getting a technical recession that we found out about months after it happened and a kind of stuttering recovery. I don't think this is us sort of coming out of that recession that we didn't feel very much at the time is the turning of the corner that everyone expects. It's not like 92 when after what felt like a really long recession, we were finally seeing things improving and the Conservatives could scare people with a really big tax rising budget that the Labour Party had. So I don't think it really works as a narrative, in short.
You don't think the electorate will be convinced?
No, I don't think the electorate looks at Rishi Sunak and his team as the people who are the only safe team to look after the economy, which is something that Gordon Brown had a little bit of, and John Major and his team certainly had back in the 90s. After seeing the Conservatives choose so often to pursue what either looks like irresponsible policies or irresponsible leaders, it just doesn't feel like a narrative they can convincingly sell, particularly when it doesn't look like most of the party are behind Rishi Sunak. If Rishi Sunak was in charge of an entirely Sunakite party that believed in the kind of fiscal conservatism that he preached really quite strongly through his leadership campaign, quite bravely, then you could maybe just about make that case. But that's not what they're looking at right now.
Jill, the other thing we've had this week has been the closing down of speculation about a May general election, although, of course, the Prime Minister has the prospect of all the other elections which are happening in May coming up. How do you think those have played into his situation this week?
Well, I have to say, I always thought a May general election was a pretty unrealistic prospect with the Conservatives where they are in the polls. The Prime Minister, I think, although Giles might not see a corner being turned, I think the Prime Minister and Jeremy Hunt definitely will. They will be saying, we told you it was going to come right, the hard work, the difficult decisions, tough choices or whatever they always go on about are bearing fruit and things are going to get better. They'll be hoping that the good news on inflation, and they will be hoping for better news in April, will be followed by a series of interest rate cuts. We've already seen some debating about that, which will mean that some of those, you know, real very acute concerns about people having to remortgage on much higher rates will be dissipated. The trouble is that people remortgaging off five-year mortgages will still see a quite substantial increase, even if interest rates do come down by a percent or something like that, which will probably take 4 interest rate changes, given the way the bank deals with these things now. So they will be trying to do that, and they will be taking that as evidence for their delay strategy, which is that the economy will be getting better. So they will have a bit of a narrative saying things are improving under us, don't let Labour wreck it. And they will still be hoping that events, they will have taken some comfort, I think, from some Keir Starmer's discomfort over Gaza, that something will happen that will make people take another look at Labour, take fright and say, well, better the devils we know in the shape of the Conservative Party. So I think it's always been a going long strategy. I think, but for Christmas, you would be looking to do what John Major did in 97, what Gordon Brown did in 2010, go right to the end. I think the only reason the autumn is in play is that too many people would be too put out, probably by having to campaign over Christmas. Though I have to say, I still wouldn't rule out January 2025.
Great. Isabel, and then, of course, this week we've had the Lords amendments discussed about the Rwanda bill. I guess one of the things which, as Jill's saying, if the government now is going to play the election a bit longer, that gives more time for their policy on Rwanda, once it gets onto the statute books, to potentially be realised, if not have the effect, the deterrent effect fully, that, you know, they won't be able to prove that in the time available, but they might be able to see some flights taking off. Do you think that is possibly going to be a game changer for them?
No, I don't think it is. And I think the more the bill is delayed, as we've seen this week with ping pong, the better that is for Rishi Sunak, because it shortens the window in which he has to face up to the reality of a policy that, you know, by all accounts, he would never have personally gone for, but which became totemic to the extent that he had to just stick by it. He has to then face up to the reality of it not working. And, you know, there's multiple ways in which it won't work. It's not, as far as I'm aware, there's no internal government modelling showing that it's working as a deterrent effect in prospect at the moment. It's all the Albania returns stuff that's causing a deterrent effect. You've obviously then got the factor of the weather, which, you know, if you have an autumn election, you will have had a summer of better weather than we've had over the winter, obviously, and much easier conditions for crossings. You've got the cost. And the recent suggestion, I think, that sort of added to this, that migrants might actually be paid for going to Rwanda, which seems to me, yeah, I'm no expert, but it seems to me to be the opposite of a deterrent if you're offering someone who gets here to then be paid to go somewhere else. I don't know. The National Audit Office report this week that it was actually costing more to set up these alternative sites for accommodation for asylum seekers in former military bases in the Bibby Stockholm barge and so on than it was to book them into hotels. You know, there's lots of levels on which this might not work, whether it's people saying that the boats haven't stopped, whether it's actually realising that the taxpayer is still paying a lot of money wherever people are going, or whether it's actually, you know, the fact that you're still having to have this debate about not feeling like Brexit sort of worked. And so in that sense, I thought that a May election, and this, you know, I thought this on the basis of talking to lots of Tory MPs, that a May-June election might actually be better, because you can sort of say, well, look, Labour's blocking us, let us finish the job, which was, I think, Rishi Sunak's slogan for at least 2 weeks, which I think is pretty good by his standards.
Just to pick up on that point, I mean, he just hasn't succeeded in shifting the polls, has he? And he's tried various different strategies. Do you think he's just had an impossible task?
So in the autumn, when I talked to Tory MPs, they'd say whether voters are listening is another matter, once they'd said all the things they thought Rishi Sunak needed to do. Now they just say, well, voters aren't listening. And some of them say, but they will start paying attention, because then they'll start thinking, oh, you know, can I afford a Labour government? But that rests on the assumption that everything seems competent at the moment. And that was one of the things that Sunak has put great store by as a prime minister, that he's someone who makes things work. But I'm not sure that even, you know, come the election, if, you know, NHS waiting lists have manifestly fallen, the people who were on them are going to be thinking, oh, that's nice that the waiting lists have fallen, but I still had to wait for a year. You know, I think they're still going to be quite annoyed about that, because stuff about your healthcare is not something you forget quickly. So, you know, it's that kind of, what are you actually selling yourself on? Is it competence? I was quite intrigued by his call this week, basically to unite by him or behind him or let the party die, because I'm not sure, and Tory MPs aren't sure, which Rishi they're supposed to be uniting behind.
Yeah. Giles, I mean, if the polls are to be believed, then the remainder of the period up until a general election would be the end of the Sunak era. You worked in Number 10 towards the end of the Theresa May era. What was that like? What should Sunak be reflecting on? What lessons should he learn from that period?
It's so interesting how different it is. I mean, because obviously she was very sad to go, and she was dethroned in a very different way. I mean, Rishi Sunak is going to be dethroned in all likelihood by the electorate, and he doesn't want to go back down in history as the guy who oversaw the total immolation of the Conservative Party, which some of the recent polls would allow. But whereas Theresa May was basically undermined by her own side and fought against it very hard because she didn't feel it was absolutely necessary. I wasn't part of that strategizing as a Lib Dem in that actual administration, but she would have felt very aggrieved and then focused the last few months on trying to get other things, non-Brexit things, through, which she did. And so in a funny way, for those of us working at the policy wonk coalface, we enjoyed a reasonably good time of getting a few things done, you know, big announcements in technology, the passage of net zero through Parliament, which was something that she's still extremely proud of. And so in a sense, we tried to sort of make the most of it and hope, as it turned out wrongly, that Johnson on coming in would realise that the correct thing to do is to tack towards the pragmatic side that she'd been trying to do and push for a reasonable Brexit, which genuinely surprised all of us when he took the other line. So it's very, very different. As far as I can see, this government doesn't have any of the same prospects. Some of the civil servants are working away on decent policies, but spending all of their time trying to think about what a likely Labour government's going to do, which seems like the only responsible thing to be doing if you're meant to be thinking into the future as a civil service. And otherwise, the cabinet ministers are, I don't really know what kind of long-term policy is going on right now in government. It seems to be all campaigning, not policy. And the campaigning is sort of damaging to long-term policy making, which is why so many people are desperate to see it sort of come to an end, or at least reach some resolution in the election.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting about prime ministers sort of reflecting on whether they were actually the sort of prime minister they wanted to be going in. You always felt that with John Major, that because of Maastricht, he was rather taken hostage by the right and felt on the rest of the policy agenda, he had to do things that weren't actually the sort of things that John Major himself really, really wanted to do. And I think actually the moves on Northern Ireland were really the genuine John Major, as opposed to lots of the other reforms. I think he sort of looked a bit wistfully probably back at the gap between his aspiration going into Number 10 in 1990 and what he actually managed to do over those 7 years. And I think a really interesting question is, are there things that Rishi Sunak will look back and say, I really wished I'd been able to move the dial on those things? And we saw one or two of those things emerging in his conference speech. You know, we saw this week the introduction of his smoke-free generation bill, quite a sort of California piece of legislation in some ways. We've seen his emphasis on trying to change the curriculum. Is he actually going to make any progress on that? I mean, he's not gone around building big consensus behind that, which you might want to do if you wanted a reform that lasted. And we've seen his initiative on chess clubs. But I mean, you know, if he's been prime minister for 2 years, it's sort of, is that it? Is that all you did? And I don't know whether there's any space in Number 10 for thinking about whether that's really what Rishi Sunak wants to be remembered by. Because as Isabel said, the problem is someone was doing this game of what one word do you associate with every prime minister. And the problem for Rishi Sunak was that the one word everybody came up with was Rwanda, or the alternative is furlough. But furlough, of course, wasn't when he was prime minister. So I think there's real risk for Rishi Sunak that he stops being prime minister and doesn't have anything that he's particularly personally proud of to show for it.
Can I just add a caveat to what I said earlier? I do think the Chancellor is acting more in that kind of Theresa May way of trying to push through things that he might well be proud of, saying, this is what I did during my brief time as Chancellor. I mean, we had that excellent event yesterday with the Permanent Secretary to the Treasury, James Bowler, and he pointed out that one of his really big tax reforms doesn't score at all well for the next 3 or 4 years. It costs money. But in 5 or 6 years' time, full expensing, which he pushed through, might be boosting investment massively. And that's the sort of thing that a chancellor with his eye on the legacy and people evaluating him as whether he's a decent chancellor would be doing. So maybe it's more the political operation in Downing Street rather than every member of the party that to whom that could be accused.
And what we don't know actually is the extent to which that budget, we saw those pictures of Jeremy Hunt and Rishi Sunak co-designing the budget, to what extent was full expense, the moves on corporation tax and full expensing, a Jeremy Hunt special, or is that maybe where we should be looking for Rishi Sunak's own legacy?
Very interesting.
This episode of Inside Briefing is supported by Naus Group. Naus is an international management consultancy that can take you from strategy and design through to transformational change. Naus has deep expertise working with public sector leaders on their most complex public policy challenges. To learn more, visit www.nausgroup.com. Okay, well, let's turn our attention to Labour, because this week saw Rachel Reeves give a big lecture setting out her economic philosophy. Giles, tell us, what is the Mays lecture and what was Reeves trying to do with her lecture?
Well, I mean, the Mays lecture is something that started, I think, in 1978. I first heard of it when referring to Nigel Lawson's in 1984, where he effectively used the Mays lecture to say there's been an entire sea change in British economic policy making, where we're no longer trying to manage inflation with microeconomic policy, which means like arguments with the unions in Downing Street. We're going to use macro policy, Bank of England, basically, and micro policies for boosting the performance of the economy long term, the supply side. Now, it sounds very dull, but this was a really important theoretical shift. And ever since then, I think people have thought, could I ever score a hit like Nigel Lawson did in 1984, where I stand up, show my intellectual chops, and actually change the nature of British policymaking for a generation? So we also saw Gordon Brown make one quite early in his tenure as Chancellor. We saw one, I think, George Osborne as Shadow Chancellor coming in and setting out his view for why austerity was the right thing to do and how it would boost the economy. And we also saw Rishi Sunak do one in February 2022 and setting out how he thinks the economy grows. So as far as I can see, the Mays lecture is a moment where chancellors or shadow chancellors set out what they think and they get to do it once, unlike the Mansion House speech, which they often give every year. So what did Rachel Reeves say? Well, it was an hour long speech. So forgive me if I do not summarise all of it. A lot of it would not be very surprising. She set out that she still believes in fiscal rules, that she's not going to be borrowing and spending like Labour chancellors are often accused of doing, that she still believes in the sort of the debt falling rule in the fifth year, which is the one that's currently constraining us. So there was a lot of disappointed noises from her left and the union saying, well, this is a bit, couldn't you have found some way of finding more money? But she also set out what she means by this term securenomics, which is something that I think she has developed in conversations with the Treasury Secretary over in the States, Janet Yellen, this idea that the state should intervene, should pursue industrial strategy in order to make people's place in the world more secure, the economy more secure against the kind of shocks that have become ever more common in the last few years, and how you would actually go about doing some of those things. And she defended some of the ideas that the Labour Party is going to push through, like tighter rules around employment. So make it harder to sort of hire and fire people, or fire people rather, the moment you've hired them. So there was an awful lot there. I don't think much of it was surprising, not because it was kind of dull, but because Labour has been quite, you know, vociferous about its business policy. There's been enormous red-tinged pamphlets called A New Business Model for Britain or Labour's Industrial Strategy. They haven't made any secrets of it, and she kind of just... mostly she kind of added to all of that with a few sort of crunchier commitments, like we're going to review national planning statements in the first 6 months. So it might mean a lot to the planning people, but I suspect didn't bother the headline writers too much. But it's worth studying. It's probably going to be a blueprint for who the person who's very, very likely to be the chancellor in a year's time is going to operate for several years. So it's one that I'm going to read and read again, I suspect.
Isabel, what stuck out for you?
Yeah, I think talking about the weaknesses of the economic analysis of New Labour, I think was striking, and also warning about the staggering blindfold towards an era of a big state. Look, neither of those things are what you'd expect to have heard from a Labour shadow chancellor for, you know, the past 15, 14 years. And I think it shows that even though in terms of policies, Labour doesn't want to scare voters. I mean, that's largely their kind of the underlying theme of what they want to do is we don't want to scare people. We want to reassure them. They still want to be challenging in two ways. One, to themselves as a party. So looking back on the mistakes that they made whilst praising New Labour overall, and obviously, you know, Keir Starmer will at every opportunity mention how often he talks to Tony Blair, almost as often as he mentions that he's kicked Jeremy Corbyn out of the party. And I think the other thing is, you know, actually challenging the government on areas where Labour has generally over the past decade not wanted to go. So, for instance, immigration, obviously, you know, Keir Starmer has really attacked on Stop the Boats a lot since I think about November. And that's quite striking because normally Labour's approach on immigration is to say, oh, you know, we're not going to talk about it. And if it's raised, we'll just say we'll do it better. Whereas on this, they're being much more aggressive. You know, I thought that was interesting that Reeves wanted to talk about things that you'd expect Labour shadow chancellors to not say, you know, to say that a big state might not be the best thing in the world, for instance. She and Keir Starmer have both talked a lot about a kind of partnership model with the private sector. So I thought, you know, I thought it was interesting. I did think it was quite funny that expectations were quite high for this, and then we were sort of walked down from those expectations that it might be more boring than we were expecting as lobby journalists. We do have quite a, you know, things have been quite exciting for the past few years. So our expectations. Yeah,
your boredom threshold is quite high.
Yeah, absolutely.
Jill, there were a few excitable headlines about Reeves praising Margaret Thatcher. Did she?
She's done the same thing that Keir Starmer and I think David Lammy have done about praying aid Margaret Thatcher as a sort of consequential prime minister who was around for quite a long time and changed the direction of the country. And that's what she was really saying. She said, look at the 70s. At the end of the 70s, you get that sense. Remember, you probably don't remember the Jim Callaghan quote about the tides are changing and things like that. And Thatcher rode that changing tide. I think that's where Rachel Reeves is saying, actually, people are now thinking we've reached a different sort of era. We really need to rethink. That's where she's billing her, I think, rather clunkily named Securenomics as how do you readjust the way we think about the economy for an era when we have to take account of geopolitical tensions. We have to be worried about, you know, much more precarious work and things like that. So both national security and individual insecurity is big issues. So I think what she's really trying to say is we want to be big, bold reformers like Mrs. Thatcher was, which I think is quite interesting. I don't think she's saying we want to do exactly everything Margaret Thatcher wants to do, because quite a lot of it, if you look at things like the New Deal for Workers, are rowing back on quite a lot of the Thatcher reforms. So I think it's quite interesting that they're saying this is the sort of difference we want to make. And it's going to take quite a long time because we hear more and more about this is not just a one-term project. I thought it was quite interesting. The thing she headlined most on was stability. That was her number one thing, which could be code for boringness. And of course, Rachel Reeves has her own reputation for being slightly boring, but she's, going with the headline, boring is good. So I think that's that. I think the really interesting thing, it'd be very interesting to know what Giles's view is on this as someone who's worked on it, is whether her growth recipe is really that plausible, because obviously growth is the get out of jail at all card, which every party is trying to play. We saw the Liz Truss attempt go down in flames. When you hear a Labour politician just say, well, the first thing we do is planning reform, as though that's a sort of easy no-brainer. Well, we have a study going on at the moment, the Institute for Government, about why successive governments promise planning reform to get more houses built and it never really delivers. So I don't know whether Giles thinks that she really has a plausible prescription now for how to re-energise the economy and get that trend rate of growth back up from an anemic plus or minus, not very much, to something more like 2-3%.
Well, I mean, the truth is there isn't a single answer to growth. There are occasional single issue fanatics like Liz Truss with the tax rate or some of the planning people with the planning stuff. But the truth is our growth rate has fallen for a lot of reasons, from the sort of in my view, extremely bad Brexit deal to a period of underinvestment under the coalition and weak demand growth, the aftershocks of the financial crisis, and sort of things we can't do very much about, like inevitable aging. But I also think the instability and inability to stick to a particular long-term strategy. When you talk to business, I know this is a terrible cliche, it's the worst cliche I promise I'll ever use in a podcast, but they complain all the time about a lack of certainty. And politicians in particular do not understand that investment is really, really hard. It's not about pulling a crank and out comes some money and then some factories are built. Getting investment wrong is why you get fired in business. And in government, as a civil servant, is extremely difficult. Not having a single sort of North Star to aim for. And political risk is the thing that is most off-putting for business people too. So sometimes it sounds like they're trying to have it all. You know, we don't have to announce more money. We're just going to be more certain and stable and less like these crazy Tories with their obsessions on sort of sovereignty and Brexit and so on. But there is something to it. I mean, we are a basically really good economy. The way that people want to come and live and work in the UK is a sign that it's a really good place in a lot of different ways. And it's taken quite a heroic concatenation of bad policies and bad behaviours for it to be a place that's so off-putting to international investors and so on. So maybe 5 years of just sort of boring sanity and we'll suddenly realise that, yeah, we can grow. Why were we asking all the time about how difficult it is? Just stop being quite so crazy.
And finally, Simon Case, the Cabinet Secretary, has returned to the spotlight this week and possibly wished that he hadn't, because it turned out that he, along with Richard Moore, the head of MI6, was a member of the Garrick Club, a private members club which, and yes, this is 2024, only accepts men as members. Jill, you had some things to say about this.
Well, so did you, of course, Hannah, she said, casting it back. I have to say, I have no desire to join the Garrick Club. There are lots of other clubs quite near here which I could join and have decided not to. Perfectly happy just my tennis club, which does admit both men and women. So I have no particular axe to grind. I was slightly taken aback, though, I have to say, when I saw the list of members of the Garrick Club, because I thought joining these exclusive all-male clubs was something which, frankly, was for a generation older than me. And I was slightly surprised when The Guardian published their list that people I regard as part of a generation younger than me were thinking this is a place where they wanted to pay their subs and spend their time hanging out with other blokes. I thought they were probably a bit past it. And it's quite interesting because one of the questions is, do you want to change it? Well, clearly a lot of women in the law, in entertainment, do feel quite strongly about this. And then you sort of think, what actually forces some of these all-male bastions to change? So I just put out a rather harmless little tweet, though an awful lot of men on my timeline seem to think that the Garrick Club and the Women's Institute are very similar institutions, which I think is quite an interesting take in itself, that perhaps we should look askance at whether people who chose to join this sort of club really were the right sort of people to lead, to be appointed to big public sector organisations, because frankly, it was only the threat to take the British Open away that forced golf clubs in Scotland to open their doors to women. It was only, I think, when they were deemed to be not in line for public funding that the MCC, a cricket club in Lords, which controls access to lots of very good games, opened its doors rather lacklustrely to women. I have to say, I felt much more strongly about the MCC than I do about the Garrick, even though I haven't applied to be a member there either.
Isabel, what did you make of this row?
Look, most of my family are MCC members. I'm not, but I cannot think of anything more boring than being a member of an all-male private members club. But then I have 7 compost bins at home, so I've got plenty of exciting stuff to keep me busy. But like Jill, I sort of was surprised that these kinds of people had joined this club, because to my mind, it does, you know, the MCC row was so long ago, and it really does send a very strong message about the kind of person you are if you want to be seen to be a member of the Garrick, I think. And I thought that most people didn't want to send that message if they were in government, because of the sort of, you know, as we've now seen, because of the sort of stigma attached to it. I mean, more widely, I can understand why people want to be members of clubs And I think the, you know, it's quite difficult for me to criticize them because I work in Parliament, which is basically like a club, particularly if you're in the House of Lords. It's like a very gold club, and you've got these lovely tea rooms, and, you know, the food's quite cheap. You don't have accommodation like you do at some London clubs, although obviously MPs do sometimes sleep in their offices. I know some MPs who thought they were going to lose their seat in the past few elections who were trying to move camp beds out discreetly from their offices. But it's a way of networking. It's a way of having a base that's not a coffee shop, that feels a little bit more professional, where you can entertain people. I can totally understand that. What I can't understand is why you'd want to be in the Garrick, but, you know, my interests are different.
Giles, various politicians were on this leaked list: Oliver Dowden, Jacob Rees-Mogg, Michael Gove. Do you think the electorate should care about them choosing to be a member of the Garrick?
It sounds very chippy. I mean, this is partly the chippiness of a guy who has tried to be home with his kids most evenings. But yeah, I think so, because it's kind of it reveals character to a certain degree, what your priorities are. I particularly don't understand the guys with families who are spending their whole time out with the evenings in all-male company. And I think when you vote for a politician, okay, you're voting for a party, you're voting for what you believe his policies are, but you're also voting for a person, someone who represents you. And I think it's an incredibly unrepresentative sort of thing to do, to be a guy who hangs around in one of these clubs or in the evenings rather than goes back and does what everyone else does. So I think, yeah, I mean, voters are constantly judging politicians. It's meant to be a personal business. And this is a really important revelation of personality, in my view. And as somebody who instead was reading endless Julia Donaldson books in the evening when my kids was young, I'm thinking, how on earth are these guys getting away with spending their whole time sitting around chomping cigars and drinking whiskey in clubs? So, yeah, by all means, let the voters take it into account.
Giles, now you say that, I suddenly realise that actually I'd love to be a member of a private members club, because I wouldn't have to listen to the Paw Patrol theme ever again.
I mean, I would pay extra for that bit.
Well, maybe the answer is these people haven't been doing any of those things, Giles. All they've been doing is sitting outside the Garrick trying to work out how to let women in. Let's give
them the fifth columnists.
Well, that's it for this week's episode of Inside Briefing. And of course, the only club worth being in is amongst the subscribers to our podcast or our IFG newsletter. Everyone's welcome. Please sign up now. A big thank you to Giles and Jill, and especially to Isabel Hardman. Thanks for being with us, Isabel. Parliament is limping towards the Easter recess, and the Prime Minister might be counting down the days. But what is worse for Rishi Sunak? MPs plotting in Westminster corridors, or MPs returning to their constituencies and hearing what their party members are thinking? It's going to be a bumpy ride, whatever happens. See you next week. This episode of Inside Briefing has been produced in association with Naus Group. Naus is an international management consultancy with deep expertise, working with public sector leaders on their organisational design challenges.